Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher. He's the author of 9 books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy. His blog, oftwominds.com, has logged over 55 million page views and is number 7 on CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. I don't know if I can live up to that all that good stuff, but I'm very excited about our topic today.
Oh yeah, you always do, always live up. And today we're talking about cryptocurrencies. You've written a lot about that on your blog, including today as we speak. With a potential price, as you suggest, of 17,000, or it's, you know, potentially it could go to that level?
Yeah, that was my sort of back of the envelope forecast a year or so ago, last summer. And, you know, I want to start out, Richard, by saying that, you know, there's a lot of people have an emotional connection to this topic of cryptocurrencies. A lot of people are extremely skeptical and feel like it's really not worth anything and certainly not worth, you know, $10,000 per Bitcoin. And other people are kind of evangelistic about it and is super excited about the blockchain, you know, disrupting all the intermediaries in our financial system. And so I think what we're going to try to do in our program is be skeptical of the whole cryptocurrency movement and be open to the potential you know, benefits that it offers, but not like we're not going to accept anything just uncritically. We're going to look at everything. That's, you know, yeah. and be if you will, agnostic. We're not going to put our belief structure in either camp, either anti-Bitcoin or pro-Bitcoin. We're just going to look at it as coolly and rationally and as we can, and try to understand the value, if there is value here.
Excellent. Yeah, I agree. And you provided some charts that we will make available on the website. Maybe we can begin there with some technology adoption curves.
Right. And you know, it's almost unbelievable when you think about it. At least it is to me. That the whole cryptocurrency space is only 8 years old. I mean, that that Bitcoin protocol was released in 2009, and it really didn't do anything for quite a while. It was kind of a hobby of certain people, and Bitcoin traded under $1 for quite a while, and then under $10 for quite a while, and then it kind of made a splash in 2013 when the Cyprus bail-in was at least one of the triggers that caused Bitcoin to suddenly come out of nowhere and go to about $1,000. And then various hacks into Bitcoin exchanges caused a complete sell-off that drove the price back down into the 200s, you know, so there was a massive sell-off. But my point is, this space is developing very quickly in a lot of different directions that are hard for us amateurs to track. In other words, there's a proliferation of cryptocurrencies, but there's also a lot of development going on in terms of like smart contracts and in the Ethereum space, in alternative cryptocurrencies that don't use blockchain technologies. And then there's a lot of development of trying to make the transaction rate of Bitcoin faster. You know, for instance, Bitcoin Cash raised the block size from 1 megabyte to 8 megabyte, and this SegWit 2 fork, which was supposed to add a layer on top of Bitcoin that would process transactions much faster. Well, that didn't go because it was withdrawn because of technical difficulties. But, you know, we it's going to be very difficult to predict where the cryptocurrency space will be in 8 more years. That's all I'm saying. You know, is that there's a lot of development and innovation going on, and most of it we know will fail or drop away, just as the internet itself proved. But what we're trying to do is ascertain the core value here, so that whether there will be some winners that will continue to develop as time goes on to meet the needs of people in our financial system, right? That's basically, if it meets a need, it will survive. If it doesn't really meet a need, if it doesn't really have utility, then it will fade and become a novelty.
Yeah, I agree very much. With those observations, I mean, you have the growth of the blockchain-based economy that is just massive potential, and then the use of cryptocurrencies as a payment mechanism for blockchain-based applications and services. Right now, there's about 1,200 cryptocurrencies in the universe. And we can see lots of mergers and acquisitions, just like what happened in the internet.com era. Many of those cryptocurrencies either going out of existence or many of them merging, some acquiring others. So that space could dwindle down to a very small number of, cryptocurrencies.
Right. And one of the other charts I proposed using for our program was a chart of the Venezuelan Bolivar, the national currency of Venezuela. And, of course, as we all know, it used to trade about 10 to 1 in terms of the Bolivar to the U.S. dollar. And now, last time I checked, which was a few months ago, it was trading around 6,000 Bolivars to the dollar on the black market. So this currency is has experienced what we call, you know, you can call it hyperinflation or a tremendous loss of purchasing power that's basically destroyed the wealth of everybody holding bolivars, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is what we're all concerned about with fiat currencies, you know, currencies that are created by central banks or national governments. And that can be created without any restraints. And so, and this is what I think part of what's driving the interest in Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies is what other financial mechanism, is available to, people who are trying to preserve their capital when their own national currencies are in free fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I've just recently, there's been a couple of quotes, one from Mike Novogratz on Bitcoin and one from Danielle DiMartino Booth on Bitcoin. And I'd just like to read you that. Mike says, "This whole revolution came out of a breakdown of trust. It came out of the 08 financial crisis when people said we no longer trust financial institutions. We don't trust governments, and in parts of the world today still. If you're in Venezuela, it's really hard to trust a central bank, or in Zimbabwe. So the decentralized revolution, which Bitcoin is really the poster child of, is a response to the breakdown in trust." And Danielle DiMartino Booth, who was a former Federal Reserve advisor to the Dallas Federal Reserve president, she mentions that Bitcoin is a reflection of panic. It's a reflection of people trying to get into a safe place, knowing the major governments of the developed world have got their printing presses running 24/7. It's a reflection of anxiety in fiat currencies and the fact it's not practical to go back to a gold standard. What scares me most about Bitcoin is the central bankers are studying it to figure out how the blockchain works. They are going to be controlling our spending with blockchain technology that is being perfected in the cryptocurrency universe. Comments?
Wow. Yeah, I think that those two, you chose quotes very wisely because those express very widely held views that I've, you know, that we've all seen expressed by a number of commentators and observers over the last few years, which is cryptocurrencies are one of the few avenues that an average person might have to escape the kind of financial repression that, you know, that you've covered in so many programs, in terms of capital controls, bail-ins, expropriations, massive devaluations of the currencies, you know, all these different tricks of financial repression, the elimination of cash. And, that's one of the driving factors. But then the fear on a lot of people's part is that the central banks and central governments are not going to just stand still. They're either going to issue their own blockchain currency and require their citizens to use only that cryptocurrency, or that they will try to ban or outlaw the existing cryptocurrencies as an extension of the financial repression.
Mm-hmm. And everybody these days is talking about the price of Bitcoin. Where is that going? You mentioned Venezuela on that chart. If we look at the history of the price of Bitcoin going up to sort of the $1,000 to $2,000 level, a lot of that seemed to have coincided with Venezuelans and also Chinese in China looking to get money out, you know, capital outflows. And then from there, it seemed to have critical mass taking off to where it is today, slightly over $10,000 as we speak. Your comments on that?
Right. Well, you know, before we started recording, you were speaking about the cost of mining Bitcoin and as being one factor in that we could use in its valuation. And so let's try to contextualize the discussion about the value of Bitcoin. And on, you know, a lot of people feel it should be zero because it's not backed by anything. And of course, then proponents say, well, there's nothing backing all these national currencies either. There's nothing backing the dollar, the yuan, the yen, or the euro either, mm-hmm. which is technically true. And so, let's move on to valuation. One factor that a lot of people refer to Bitcoin in particular as having a big impact on the valuation is it's a scarce entity. In other words, there's only 21 million Bitcoin that will ever be mined, and beyond that amount, then there will be a fee structure to support the blockchain, right? Because currently the whole blockchain is maintained. It's basically paid for by the issuance, you know, the emittance of new Bitcoin. And I think you had some numbers that you found on the estimates of how much that costs in terms of electricity and computing power to mine one Bitcoin.
Yeah, right now it's approximately $1,000 U.S. to perhaps $1,200 U.S. to mine one Bitcoin, and that represents the cost of electricity to do that, computing resources. It's similar in the gold world, where it costs approximately $500 to $800 per ounce to mine 1 ounce of gold today. So on that basis, if we look at the value of gold as being $1,300 today relative to the cost of its mining, Bitcoin could approximately be valued at something like $1,500 to $2,500 U.S. Relative to its mining cost.
Right, right. And so in that analysis, it's like overvalued, you know, by a factor of four. Then alternatively, we can say in a world where national currencies and central bank currencies are no longer trustworthy because they've been created in vast sums and continue to be created to the tune of like $300 billion a month or more, that maybe what's really happening is gold is lagging. And this has, of course, been frustrating to a lot of people who feel that maybe gold should be 5,000 an ounce. If Bitcoin's 10,000, then gold shouldn't be 1,300. It should be 5,000 an ounce. And so it may be that it may be that gold is lagging and to where it should be. But you know, let's look at the value. Let's look at the utility value of these alternatives currencies, and I'm including precious metals are the historical safe haven, because they have intrinsic value, and in the case of silver, they have utility value as well. I mean, that we all know that silver is not only pretty and a nice thing to make art out of. It's also an industrial metal with that's widely consumed. So we understand the utility value and the store of value of precious metals, and then Bitcoin is obviously it's a different animal because it's a digital thing and it has no physical presence and no physical utility, but it is quite handy. In terms of transferring capital around the world, and I myself have used it to pay editors and translators in other countries, and you know, there's no fooling around with bank fees, and you don't have to fill out any of the capital control forms required by the federal government, and this is of course why a lot of people feel that Bitcoin, you know, it's all about money laundering and drug money. But I'm just a little regular person here doing running my little business, and I used it to pay other people doing, you know, legitimate services for me, and I filed on my tax return, you know, what little gain I made on my Bitcoin holdings. So, you know, I think there's a legitimate utility to the Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency space in terms of regular people transacting business globally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sort of that mobility as a utility factor, and as mentioned earlier, that seemed to what happened to propel the price to go from up to $1,000, $2,000 per Bitcoin, especially from Venezuelans and Chinese using it. And there is a development just in the last month or two that I'd like to mention. That has to do with the internet protocol of Bitcoin. So most, if not all, on the cryptocurrencies are operating over the internet, over the IP internet protocol space. And there are technologies coming out now that are able to detect Bitcoin transactions, Bitcoin traffic, even if the traffic is encrypted. So this is quite new. As that develops, this will actually make it possible for banks to look at bringing into regulatory oversight the cryptocurrencies and the traffic that's coming to and from the banks, and even governments as well, into and out of countries. So this mobility advantage initially may not hold as much, you know, given this technological development. China, the government of China has long been looking at this on how to do it, but technologically, this recent development may be what's happening, and may be now you know, to be used by banks and governments.
Right, and that's an excellent topic and observation. I wasn't aware of this technology, but I think what it raises for me is the regulation of the cryptocurrency space is inevitable in developed economies. You know, in other words, like this is the normal trend, and frankly, I think it's a good trend in the sense that if you want to legitimize a new form of money, it has to be regulated to some degree so that people won't get ripped off by fraud, like people selling Bitcoin they don't actually own, or you know, this kind of thing. And I also think that you know, if people are fortunate enough to make, you know, $1 million trading cryptocurrencies, then why shouldn't they pay the same tax as somebody that was fortunate enough to make $1 million trading stocks or bonds or future contracts? So I think the advent of regulation is a positive development. And the reason why I say that also is some countries are embracing the cryptocurrency space. And I mentioned Japan, which has legalized Bitcoin, I mean, fully, right? And, of course, this is the third largest economy in the world. And South Koreans have basically given a pass, said they're not going to ban it, which is taken as a form of approval. And the U.S. itself has deemed Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies as commodities. So that, in other words, they're viewed as, if you're trading Bitcoin, it's viewed as equivalent to trading pork bellies or something, right? Ooh. It's a commodity. So I think it's once a country like Japan, with a huge capital market and a vast economy, now that it's legalized the cryptocurrencies, it's very difficult for other economies to say, oh, no, we're going to ban this. And so I think we have to be draw a distinction between common sense regulation of the cryptocurrency space, like legalizing it and regulating it and taxing it, right? As opposed to banning it. And I'm not so sure that banning it is going to work anymore. Because I've explained on my blog a couple of times, if, for instance, the United States decided to ban cryptocurrencies, well, I could take my Bitcoin, you know, my one Bitcoin or whatever, and I could put it on a thumb drive or, you know, so-called hard wallet. And then I could take it with me to Japan, or I could mail it in a package with some other stuff. And then I could have an associate or friend in Japan, you know, upload it and deal with it in a legal country, where a legal setting mm-hmm. for cryptocurrencies, and then transfer it into yen or dollars in that country where it's legal to do so, and then transfer it back to the U.S. And so, you know, if I can figure out a really simple workaround, pretty much anybody can. So I think where a lot of people fear this tracking of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies and regulating it is a bad thing. It doesn't have to be a bad thing. I think it could be a positive development, actually.
Yeah, and it will accompany the growth in blockchain-based services as the economy develops around those based services. The concept of an encrypted Excel spreadsheet type of ledger that blockchain is.
That's right, and I'm glad you described it so succinctly, because a lot of people are confused by it, and that's really what it is. It's basically a ledger that's public, so everybody gets to see what's been entered, and so that's. That's the utility value. Well, you know, let's also go back to the financial repression part, because one thing I've started to write about, and other people have also started to write about, is the possibility that we finally get some inflation. We all know that unofficial inflation, real world inflation, is running a lot hotter than official inflation. But so far, the central banks of the world have created, trillions upon trillions upon trillions of new currency, and they've injected that into the financial sector. And there's been only asset inflation, right? In other words, stock markets have doubled and tripled, and, you know, bonds have risen in value, and real estate's gone back up to bubble levels. But there hasn't been a lot of real world inflation, and certainly no wage inflation. Mm-hmm. So if we started to get inflation, that's going to create a real problem for the central banks, because they won't be able to emit the quantities of currency they've been emitting, because that will fuel inflation. And inflation, of course, destroys capital. It destroys the savings. It destroys the purchasing power of wages. And people actually have less money to spend, less purchasing power, you know. So it's that's, I think, another driver for the whole cryptocurrency space, is that if cryptocurrency is perceived as something that is a store of value based on scarcity, it becomes an attractive hedge against inflation.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good observation. So where do we go from here? Like, what will happen? How do you see the cryptocurrency space evolving? I guess we have private-based cryptocurrencies, and then there'll also be government-based cryptocurrencies.
Right. My sense is the value of cryptocurrencies like Ethereum and Dash and Bitcoin. In other words, the we can call these the leading cryptocurrencies. The value is that they're non-state, non-central bank, non-government, right? And so I don't see a cryptocurrency issued by the Bank of China or the Federal Reserve as having any value, because the control of how much of that cryptocurrency is emitted, is created, is of course still in the hands of the bank. And so I think the fear of anybody that is at all skeptical of how government and central banks work is a central bank can say, oh, well, there's only going to be 21 million of these coins issued. And then the next morning they say, oh, well, actually, we're going to issue 300 million. And then it's 300 billion. and then the currency has no value at all. And so I think we have to kind of specify that the value of Bitcoin is that being decentralized, you can't change the protocol. No one person or agency can say, no, we've decided to issue 210 million Bitcoin now. It doesn't work like that. And that even if somebody claimed that we're going to do this to the Bitcoin protocol, the miners and everybody, the participants in the Bitcoin ecosystem, they would have to follow along and support that. And if they didn't support it, then that fork would die. In other words, it would just vanish. Mm-hmm. And so if I declare, hey, I'm going to start a new a version of Bitcoin that there's a billion Bitcoins, and nobody comes along to mine that, in other words, maintain the blockchain, then my version just dies. It goes to zero because mm-hmm. there's nobody to support the blockchain. So there is a rough and ready, very free market kind of democracy, if you will, and a lot of people have criticized Bitcoin because it major miners obviously have a lot more influence than people who are mining as a hobby and so on. And so there are blocks of self-interested people who can dominate these cryptocurrencies, and that's a danger for sure. But it's a lot different than having nine people meet in a room and decide to add a zero.
mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
To the money.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And so I think that the government and central bank versions of cryptocurrency are going to go nowhere, because they're not, again, for the element you described earlier in the program, there's really no reason to trust them.
Mm. I mean, they may be mandated by governments to use, just like, you know, currencies today of the countries of the world. But I guess with the coexistence with private-based cryptocurrencies, the ones that make sense will be ones that are, first operating within the financial system, even if they're outside of the banking system, if you will, but still within the financial system, and ones that are based on sound money, so that they have limited numbers that they can be printed, or perhaps they're based on a commodity like gold.
Right. And yeah. I think that you raise an excellent point, that what people are seeking is sound money, and sound money that has utility. In other words, it's not just a store of value, but it's mm-hmm. a means of exchange. And so there's certainly a role for the precious metals. And that's why a lot of people are saying, if you're going to, in terms of recommending a hedge, that you should have both precious metals and some cryptocurrency, you know, exposure, even if it's, you know, 1% or something. But I think we, you know, I would say we're sort of in the equivalent of the internet or the World Wide Web around 1995, you know, and so we have, back when the first browser emerged, right? And, Mozilla and all that.
Okay.
And
yes.
all the assumptions that we would have drawn from that have all turned out differently, right? In other words, like Yahoo was the firstest with the mostest, and and then Yahoo faded and lost all of its advantages.
Ooh.
And so we you know, to say where will Bitcoin be in 8 years, gosh, I would hate to even say. I mean,
ooh,
it could be surpassed by a new cryptocurrency or an entirely new cryptocurrency protocol, and then it becomes a legacy system. Or that's definitely a possibility, right? Something comes in that's faster, better, cheaper, and it's gonna take all the market space away from the existing cryptocurrencies. You know, that's what we want. We want innovation. We want faster, better, cheaper. And that's part of what we like about the cryptocurrency space, is it's still open to that kind of thing compared to so much of the developed economies are controlled by monopolies, cartels, central banks, governments. Which are only self-serving. You know, they only choose policies and enforce policies that protect the few at the expense of the many. On the other hand, Bitcoin could transition into being something that's slow, right? It's slow and secure. It's never going to work in terms of buying a coffee at Starbucks with Bitcoin. That's just a dead duck. It's transaction rate is just too small. But it might be useful in interbank transfers or large financial transfers. Maybe Bitcoin will find a home in that space, while other cryptocurrencies will arise to take care of the transactions on the level of consumer goods. You know, we don't know.
And you had a chart that shows if Bitcoin replaces or becomes part of reserve currency, we could see prices in the $500,000 range.
Yeah.
I see that. Yeah,
I know, and it's so funny because, you know, I've been following Bitcoin, but I never bought any, and I was just kind of an interested observer until I needed it as for its utility value. In other words, I needed to buy some Bitcoin in order to pay the translators I had in Venezuela, because that was the only form of currency that they could access, right?
Wow.
That made sense. And if you think that the world economy is going to enter a time of instability where a lot of things start falling apart, then of course we can say that Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies will maintain their utility value for that reason. In other words, if people can access it and pay their debts and buy stuff with it, then, or buy other currencies with it, then it's going to have utility value. I have another chart here, the logarithmic progression of Bitcoin, and it's obviously kind of a rough guess, but this chart suggests that there's a logarithmic function to the number of days that it takes for Bitcoin to advance tenfold. In other words, to go up by 10 times. And so it was kind of like, how long did it take to go from a dollar to 100, and or to a $10, then to 100, then to 1,000, and then to 10,000. And so, of course, we can play these kind of games. And, you know, it's those of us who like charts, you know, we love, like, tracking charts and making projections and
yeah.
stuff. But it's really – we don't know.
Yeah. But actually, your logarithmic regression chart does seem to be fairly accurate. The November 22 date for 10,000, that's pretty much on track.
Yeah, it is. And this was, I think, the projection was made in late 2014.
Wow.
So by this chart, if that regression kind of goes, continues as charted, then we would be at 100,000 Bitcoin in 2021.
Okay.
Yeah. So, wow, we have to wait a whole 4 years.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm laughing because this is all speculation, right? But we really don't know what's going to happen. And what I like to say is this is the way markets should operate.
Yes.
They shouldn't be manipulated by central authorities. Yes. So they always go higher.
Right.
And there's never any retrace. There's no volatility. Volatility's been destroyed in the stock market, right? It's been erased. And so there's no real price discovery. Because there's no volatility, there's no price discovery. So Bitcoin is extremely volatile, and to me, part of that is, number one, it has a very low float. you know, that of the 17 million Bitcoin, several million are estimated to have been lost in hard drive crashes and things like that. The founders have about a million Bitcoin that they've never touched. It's never moved for whatever reason. And a lot of people are pursuing the idea of hold on for dear life, otherwise known as HODL. and so the actual tradable float of Bitcoin is probably a relatively small percentage of the 17 million or 18 million Bitcoin that are out there. So you got a very small float, and like a small float in stocks, you get big volatility when there's a small float. And then if it, the more open the market is, the more volatility you have, right? Because you're exposed to human emotions, and there's more surges of euphoria and panic and all the things that drive volatility. So I don't see volatility going away.
Wow, that's excellent insights for a balanced view that we started out with, Charles. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com.
Great. Thank you very much, Charles, for being on the show. We'll do it again.
Yeah, thank you so much, Richard. It's my pleasure. Great topic.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.